Hello and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast, My Dinner with Andre episode. Not My Dinner with Andre, the movie My Dinner with Andre. We're going to have dinner with Andre Rublev. I've already eaten dinner, though. And, you know, it's a little past dinner time. I'm not sure what they do in Russia, but we're going to have dinner with Andre Rublev. We're going to just bandy some ideas back and forth, talk about some thoughts and some dreams and some ideas and just where we're at in the world with life and things. And we're joined by the real star of the show. And his name, ladies and gentlemen, is Corky McDonald. Comedy legend, I've heard it say.
Well,
the man who needs no introduction.
And
even
yet,
though I'm still in the middle of it. And it's been going on forever.
Dan, I gotta say, I'm confused on this Rublev character. I watched the 1992 film with Ray Liotta and a young Thora Birch, Andre, about the seal.
Sure.
And I gotta tell you, canon. Although, yeah. I mean,
no.
Absolutely. I didn't even make it through the first 15 minutes, but I was like, yep, this is the goods.
Right. That's a real swing and a miss. But wrong Andre. We got the wrong Andre that should have been a seal, but we got the Russian icon painter. Still pretty good. Still pretty good.
You don't know he wasn't a seal.
You don't know? But will he get our seal of approval? Oh,
folks.
It's just brought it right back. Brought it right back to it. Yeah. But yeah, Rublev, I don't know, is that the same guy who made Rublev's cube? And is that different than Rubik's cube? Is that a different thing? I don't know.
Yeah, did he change his name to some kind of similar, and then just for this one thing say, I want to make a puzzle for people to play as adults and children?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we don't know. There's the history, records from that time, spotty at best. Honestly, we don't know that. Okay, apparently someone invented the parachute back in the 15th century, right? Who knew?
Who knew that?
That's a thing. So Rublev, Rubix, you know, Parker Brothers stole Monopoly. Look it up. Because I can't remember what it is, but they did. So look it up and then tell me.
Speaking of Monopoly, you know who has a monopoly on our hearts? Our PayPal
segways are killing it. These are
speaking
amazing.
Of free parking. You know who has parked a space in our hearts? You know who's just visiting the jail of our hearts? It's our PayPal donors. We want to take a moment to thank each and every one of you individually with big kisses on your tuchus. Our donors are the heroes of the show. We wouldn't do it without you, to be honest. We just would stop doing it, but we couldn't do it without you too.
We thank you all
so much for your support.
Absolutely. And if you'd like to donate to the show, head down to Ventnor daredaniel.com. Find the menu at the top of the page and click support the show. Or find the donate button on the homepage. You can make a one-time donation, monthly donation. Anything you contribute helps keep this show going. Yeah, as Corky said, without our donors, I think we'd probably just wander out into the desert disappear, possibly. Sheltering sky level, kind of just like disassociation from who we are and what civilization is. So, you're the thin line. Keeping that from happening. No pressure. This is a low pressure cell.
Tonight's episode, we will be discussing Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev. The IMDb synopsis for Andrei Rublev: the life, times, and afflictions of the 15th century Russian iconographer Saint Andrei Rublev.
Yes, this week's film, it's Andrei Rublev, directed by Andrei Tarkovsky, co-written by Tarkovsky, and yet another Andrei Konchalovsky. We reviewed Mirror way back when, a year, 2 years ago? I can't even remember now. And we both liked it. We both really liked it. However, it was probably as close as you can get to like getting into the Cannon Fodder canon without doing it. It was like the shot where it like goes around the rim a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Like it just kind of, where it like bounces on and in the rim and on the backboard. And you're just like, how is that not going? Like it was just every part of the rim. Somehow fell off. Well, I, you know, me, I did it. Looking in the mirror, there he is, arrests that man. But from my notes, I said, those compositions, those camera movements, that lighting, the overall audacity and beauty and majesty and terror, it's ravishing cinema. Seven features, a documentary, a handful of shorts, and several screenplays. Three of his films made the Sight and Sound Top 250 in 2022. Mir was the highest one at number 31. Stalker at number 43. Andrei Rublev got into number 66, but it's placed as high as 12 in Pascal's. It was 27 in the previous one. They do this every 10 years, remember? In 2012, it placed 27th. So it is sort of, I mean, again, these movies were, 20 years apart, I think. Mir was from the 80s, I believe, and then, or was it? No, it was the 70s, right? Yeah, so these are about 10 years apart. 5-10 years apart. My dates are all just all over the place. But it's sort of a similar, the style is developing and has developed along these sort of lines of these existential themes and the sort of long takes, this and this sort of what to me really personifies like the Tarkovsky film or epitomizes them is like this mix of like a really hyper vivid reality that sort of blends with memory and dream. And they all sort of exist on this sort of same plane. They're not like separately delineated, like this is one and that's the other. Like in Mir and in this film, you have this dialectic between like this really extremely realistic depiction with memory and dream and then like spectacle as well. Tarkovsky and Konchalovsky, they worked for more than 2 years on the script, doing a lot of research in medieval history and art. Tarkovsky, he wanted to make a film about the development of the artist, not the art itself, really, but the effect of his culture and his society on his time and his art and his faith. Because remember, he's a religious iconographer. He's a monk, basically, and an icon painter. So there's this dialectic throughout the film about art, faith, and how do you recollect, you know, how do you reconcile these with like the horrible realities of the world? And Tarkovsky himself, he's living in a secular society in communist Soviet Union, communist Russia, making a film about the importance of faith in art and in life, right? It's a film about visionaries and about people with great talent and ambition and faith kind of meeting up against entrenched power and ignorance. The initial budget was approved by the government, but cut several times during production, so they had to simplify or excise certain sequences. And that's insane, watching this movie, to think, like, this is the simplified version? Holy fuck. Like, wow. Holy crap. The original cut ran 205 minutes. It was called The Passion According to Andre. Violent, there's nudity in the film, and then just the kind of content, as we talked about. Ideological erroneousness, that's what the Soviet censors called it. It was cut to 186 minutes, but he refused to go any further. It never screened in Russia until 1971. It was 1966 when he made the film. It screened once in Russia. Never again until 1971. It screened at Cannes in 1969. Soviet officials demanded it only be screened once out of competition. It screened at 4 a.m. Imagine watching this movie at 4 a.m. So, like, I just flew to France. I'm going to watch Andrei Rublev at 4 a.m. That's amazing. Still won the Fipresky Prize, which is the international award. Today, it's widely considered one of the greatest films ever made. It's on like every credible list of the best movies of all time, and has been for a while. Lists compiled by The Village Voice, Cahiers du Cinéma, the Toronto International Film Festival, and the Vatican. This is on the best movies list for the Vatican. Yeah. So, Corky, when I watched this film, I got memories of several movies that we've reviewed and a number that we've canonized on the show. Obviously, Mirror, for
sure.
It's the same filmmaker. But Come and See. I mean, I had to Come and See during that really horrifying siege of Vladimir. Color of Pomegranates. Mm-hmm. I think that, again, the dialectic between faith and art and all the really prominent aesthetics of it. Agira, The Wrath of God. Again, I think that mix of like a vivid realism and the dreamlike quality of it. But then I also thought about the literally, and I looked this up, it is the least seen film in our canon. The 1962 Francesco Rossi film, Salvatore Giuliano. And why did I think of that, Quirky? Why? Because in Andrei Rublev, the title character is not necessarily the main character.
No.
And in his throughout the film, and certainly not in the individual chapters of the film as we go along. It's not a biopic, just like Salvatore Giuliano is not a biopic, but it's a portrait of this person within his times, right? The effect of him on the times on him. And again, it's really about this like art and faith butting up against the vicious realities of the time. So again, a lot of movies that we've canonized or come close to canonized, a lot of films that we talk about as some of the best that we've ever seen, you know, I mean, that's why it's in the canon. Andrei Rublev, did you solve Rublev's cube, and does this belong in the canon?
Okay, so you know that meme of the high school football player being interviewed, and he's saying, they had us in the first half, I ain't gonna lie. That was this movie for me.
Yeah.
Like, the first half of this movie, I was like, these fucking critics with their pretentious, snooty, head up their own fucking ass shit, these biopics of these long-dead saints and martyrs, God damn, they just like jerking themselves off. Because this sucks. And not suck, but God, this is just the same thing over and over again. And the second half, it's like the greatest fucking movie of all time. And even while I appreciated the technical craft of the first half, because it looks amazing, and the where they shot, everything about it, I'm like, I should love this fucking movie. I love real sets. I love stripped down. It you couldn't tell this wasn't 500 fucking years ago. Mm-hmm. I love this stuff. The second half does that and then some, and has that extra touch to it. And it's, and when we say second half, this is a 186 minute movie, so you've got a good second half of the most brutal.
Ooh.
I mean, it's not happy.
Stunning.
Fucking amazing. Amazing. Yeah.
I mean, I think that level of spectacle is there throughout. Maybe it was a little harder to appreciate because it is much more like kind of talky. It's not as like visceral. It's a lot more theoretical. And as I'm talking about Salvatore Giuliano, like I say, he's not. Not only is he not like the main character in a lot of these stories, especially in that second half, right? He becomes much more of an observer, especially.
Yeah.
He's an observer really throughout the film, but especially in that second half, he almost is like not really a part of it except as someone who's just watching it happen. Like, he's become so disassociated from anything there. But I do think the first half is really kind of setting the ground for why that second half works so well, you know.
I agree.
I think is if you come back to it, you know,
a
lot of it sort of pays off, right? Things that seem like disconnected in that first half, you're like, what, like, what, why is any of that, like, who the fuck, right? So for example, like, I'm thinking about, yeah, the movie's Andrei Rublev, but there is these two brothers in this movie, right? The Grand Duke and his brother, and this like war, this like rivalry between the brothers is this like thread that goes through like most of the movie, especially like the second half of the movie, and like the effects of like what they do on each other. And they're both horrible, horrible people, right? Like, of what we get to know about them, which is very, very little, right? And everyone except them is like living in this hell on earth, you know what I mean? And so like, as it goes on and keeps going, so like in the second half, like, you have the raid sequence, right? And as we find out, it's the brother, and he's coming to take over the Grand Duke, right? Like, he's the Grand Duke has a son, the brother wants to take over, and so he sacks this village, which is Vladimir, and it happens to be where Andrei Rublev has been painting the church and is barricaded in there with most of the populace. But as we've seen, the Grand Duke could give fuck all about, like, killing, murdering, torturing, all of the horribleness, like, all of the rape and the pillage and the fires and the sacrilege and everything that happens. It's so, like, unnecessary. It's just such a product of, like, cruelty. It does nothing to the Grand Duke, right, who is just as cruel, maybe more so, like, does things that are just as bad and maybe even worse, and is just scary people. But that's what I mean about, like, the first half stuff, things seem sort of oblique, like, some of this, like, the dialect between, like, art and faith and, you know, why are you creating art? Are you doing it for God? Are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it for other people? And then finally, it all kind of comes together, I think, in that last sequence with the bell, which is somehow the best sequence in the, I mean, it, which is saying something, but it's even better.
It doesn't even feature Andre until, like, the end of it.
He's barely even in it. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's just really fascinating how this movie works. And it starts with the prologue, which also does not feature Andre and seems totally disconnected to anything else going on here. But again, I think it's establishing these themes, right? The theme of a visionary.
Yeah.
Who is both a product of his time and yet, like, beyond his time.
Yep.
And like the kid with the bell, like Andre with his icon paintings, he's trying to create something transcendent here on Earth. He's trying to, like, reach out to God in a way that no human, like, ever has, right? And to connect humanity to God and to that, you know, level of faith. It's an absolutely amazing sequence. But again, it's just, like, it's very confusing because you're like, what is happening with any of this? But as it turns out, it's just this guy who is, like, homemade a sort of parachute hang glider, and the mob is coming to tear it down. I don't know why the mob's coming. They don't explain. Blasphemy, witchcraft. Like, what? Why? Whatever reason mobs come to, like, tear things down, right? But it actually works. He does fly. He does, like, get to see this world from the proverbial bird's eye view. And it's all, like, achieved with these, like, amazing crane shots and these POV shots. And it's really, like, terrifying and magical. And then he dies. Like, he just, boom. He doom, water, dead. And that's it. That's the end of the prologue. And we don't, never any more about the hang glider or anything like that. But it's just, again, it's a visionary who's trying to do something, like, beyond himself, something transcendent.
Yeah. This being my second Tarkovsky movie, I absolutely loved Mir, but I get that he talks about himself in these movies. He uses these characters and films as a chance to explore his own, what he sees as his shortcomings, what he sees as his purpose, and how he wants to deliver it. And in this one, this opening is pure. As you said, I'm a man out of my time. I'm a visionary. Mm-hmm. The masses want to stop me, but I'm going to see things that no one else has seen before. Like, this is not the time where helicopters and planes and fucking just even big buildings were common. This person saw things that nobody else saw while flying, a thing that nobody else did. And made people witness something that they'd never seen before. And if I die at the end, fuck it. I did what I needed to do and created something wholly unique that it hadn't existed before. And then that's it. That's like, boom, here's your introduction to this movie.
That's
which,
it.
Okay, so like I said, the first half, not going to lie, they had me in the first half. especially after such a, like, energetic and, like, enthusiastic opening, then we just get slow meditations on the purpose of art and patronage and what do you really believe in. Each one of these scenes is important, and like you said, it does come back, but at the time you don't know it quite.
No, absolutely. And as you said, like, it's broken up into these chapters, right? And it's jumping, like, through the years as is jumping through the chapters, okay? You know, so we're jumping around to things. Sort of like 30, it's like a weird comparison, but the 32 films about Glenn Gould, they're not, like, some of the films about Glenn Gould in that movie aren't really important, right? A lot of them don't have anything to do with anything significant about his life or career. They're just sort of like evocative of his personality or his time or the people around him or something like that. And that's what these next three chapters, it's a lot of that. It's a lot of like, we don't actually see him, like a big part of these next two chapters is this commission to paint the Cathedral of the Annunciation in Moscow, which apparently this is like the first time that Andrei Rublev appears on the historical record. It's like 1405 or something like that. It's one of his most famous, most important things he's ever done. Do we see him paint one single drop of it? No, no, we don't. And that's a little like, off-putting a little bit, right? Or alienating, I should say, as a viewer, to be like, okay, we're going to see him paint the Annunciation, and that's going to be this important thing. No, we're not. We are not going to see him paint a single drop, talk about it, think about it, do anything about it. We're going to move way on beyond it. And as you said, what instead we have are these long scenes where it is a lot of talking and a lot about, you know, art, what it means to you, what it means to you as a person of faith. Are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it for God? You know, and we have this like kind of dynamic setup. Andre, we meet these three monks. They're all monks and they're all icon painters. It's Andre, Danil, and Kirill, and none of them really stand out, right, amongst each other. I guess Andre stands out because he seems like the youngest and the most handsome of them all, and he has the most movie star kind of looks about him. But he, again, is just an observer. Like, he has great faith, but what he's really searching for is something in humankind, right? Whereas the other two are, they're not complicated, right? Danil is just like, I just want to paint, I just want to do my thing, whatever. And then Kirill is like the Salieri to Andres Amadeus, right? Like, he envies his talent, he wants all the glory that would go to him, and he's a real backstabber, as it turns out. But this just manifests itself in, again, long scenes of people talking about art, and we don't really see any of the art, you know what I mean? Like,
which
again,
I enjoyed thinking about that in a modern biopic, we would get the moment that he got the inspiration to paint it, or he would see the look he wanted to capture in some person walking down the street or something like that, and then a needle drop of a song would kick in and he would start painting, and we'd get that moment, we get that fucking Jackson Pollock moment where you've cracked the code, Pollock, you broke
right,
through.
Yeah, like in Bohemian Rhapsody where everything's like,
yes,
oh, wait, what did you say? It's like a rhapsody, but a what rhapsody? We will what you? Yeah, just terrible. But yeah, it's not ingratiating itself to the audience like something like Bohemian Rhapsody is trying to do and make everyone feel like comfortable and like everything's very familiar. Instead, I think like we're getting, like I said, a portrait of the times, a portrait of the Middle Ages in Russia, and just how harsh it is, how cruel it is, how brutal it is. And really, like, Andre's discovering this for the first time too, because again, he's been in a monastery
for nine years or so.
He's a monk. He's an adult. He has no real experience of the world. And he's going out and it's brutal. It's brutal. A jester does a funny little bit about the guy in charge, and next thing you know, he's being dragged off because somebody like ratted on him, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, that's the first thing he sees, you know, that's number one. And then it just keeps going from there. And so he has these sort of like pent up sort of cloistered ideas on the world, and he gets a real harsh dose of reality throughout the film. So we have these first few chapters here. So it's the jester scene. There's Theophanes the Greek. Theophanes makes a real dick move. I mean, never trust a Greek, honestly, in these kind of situations. I mean, not to cast aspersions, but really. Theophanes, he's not representing you well. His dick move is that he basically makes a under the table agreement with Kirill that he's going to get to do this thing. He's going to do the cathedral in Moscow, and that's going to be this big thing. And instead, he sends a note. He was going to show up in person, tell everybody, make a big show about it. This guy's amazing. I handpicked him. He's the best. He's going to do it. And he's going to do it for free. And instead sends a note and is like, I want Andrei Rublev. and that's it. And Kirill just has a bit of a meltdown, as they say.
Yeah, we're living in extreme poverty. Doesn't even begin to describe it, because I don't even think money entered into anybody's life. It was, do you have a potato that day? Is the potato rotten? You know, no. Then you're set. That's
no. Wealth. It's everyone is filthy. Everyone, again, except for the Grand Duke and his brother and the people in their immediate vicinity. They're all nice and clean. It's just like the whole Monty Python thing. Like, he's the king. You can tell because he doesn't have shit all over him.
Yeah. Right?
Like all of us. Like, we're in the shit, and literally everyone's got shit all over him. Right. They are just, their clothes or whatever fits on your body. You know. I mean, it is. It's a visceral movie. Even like I said, during these early parts, which are slow, they are contemplative, they take a while to build, doesn't seem like there's a lot happening. Even here, like, the aesthetics of the film are just amazing. What I was amazed by, like, okay, so all these crowd shots are amazing. Like, so we get to, like, the pagan scene, right?
Yes.
Where the pagans are having their religious holiday, right? Which is also about love and about all these other things and so on. But yes, these movements are amazing, but like, what makes it amazing is like the movement of the camera, but then also all the movement within the frame as well. Like, I think it's just amazing how Tarkovsky uses like screen direction, both again for movement of his camera and movement of things in the frame, not just left to right, and not even just left, right, up, down, or diagonal, but he's using like three-dimensional, like, things go up diagonally over while the camera's moving another way. It's just like the movement of everything is absolutely stunning. It's so complex, like remarkably complex, but
remarkably.
You don't feel the weight of it, right? The camera actually has this feeling of like you're floating sort of through the action, right? It's constantly on a crane. It's constantly moving forward and back and around and about. It just has this feel of like, again, it's hyper real, and yet it's too real to be real. It's so vivid.
There's
so powerful.
There's a scene, and I do not know how they got this, of just a king's court coming out of the walled city, and peasants are all out, and they must genuflect and prostrate themselves in front as they gallop past slowly. There's hundreds of people out here.
Yeah.
And not one of them like looks at the camera or in the direction or is off time. They're all keyed the fuck in. And it's not like the camera's right in front of them. It's shot from far enough away to where they didn't know exactly when this was being captured. It's just, I don't know how they got that. Like, you never get that. There's always like one
amazing
extra fucking up.
Oh, absolutely right. And they're not like faking it in the way of like, oh yeah, okay, you can see like a third of those are dummies or something like that. No, they're all real people. Everyone's all those pagans are all running and through the real forest with their real naked bodies. You know, everything's actually happening as it's actually happening. And it's so brilliantly, brilliantly coordinated. It's really unbelievable. And it happens in, like I said, some of these huge sequences, like the pagans or the raid on Vladimir, or you know, some of the other big sequences in the Bell, you feel it. But then also there's like the scene where he's talking with Theophanes the Greek, who is this sort of mentor of his in iconography, and they're talking about their views on religion and the meaning of it all. And in the background is like a passion play. Like, is a literal, like, crucifixion is happening in the background. Actual Calvary is happening. The march, you know, And so there's this, like, foreground, background thing.
Yeah.
Again, like, these multiple planes of reality, dream, memory, and yet they're not separate planes, right? In a lot of movies, you know, I think especially, like, a Hollywood movie, like, there's a real, like, we're not going to let people know, like, this is a dream, okay? Like, you're going to know it's a dream. You're going to know when it's a fantasy. This is, like, it's all sort of mingling. It's all sort of right there.
He talks to a dead comrade at one point, And there's no Vaseline on the lens to let you know this is imagined. You know, there's no music cue.
He's not a Force ghost. Like,
oh, huh?
He's not a Force ghost.
Yeah, there's not like a Force Star Wars. Ghost. It's just like now he's talking to a dead guy.
Yeah. And it's done in this really elegant way. Again, that's Theophanes, the Greek who he's talking to. And it's done in this way where it's like one shot. There's a lot of really like long single shots. That's another Tarkovsky.
But never tedious with it. Never like the movements are all make it fresh. Not just of the camera, but of people. The blocking is amazing.
Absolutely. Like in the sequence with Theophanes after the raid on Vladimir, where he's appearing on either side of him, right? Uh-huh. Like he kind of leans one way and then he debates this point and then kind of leans the other way and debates the other point. And there's Theophanes on the other way. And they're doing this through a practical means of the guy playing Theophanes walked around the camera the other way and appeared on the other side, right? But it's done in such a graceful, like elegant, seamless sort of way that it's really, really beautiful and just an amazing moment in the film. So part one, it's a lot of seemingly kind of disconnected things.
If it was all part one, I would admire it for its look, but I would not call it a great movie.
Mm-mm. But part one ends, part two starts, and holy moly, boy, does it start with a bang. It starts with the Tatar raid on Vladimir. And again, this is where Andre kind of moves into the background, right? Because we are well into this siege of the scene before we even realize that he's there. He's still there. This is where the church that at the end of part one, he was inspired to paint the feast. And here he is, and it's covered in paint and everything. It's several months later.
And even kind of coming off the first part, it's not necessarily a quick build. Like, you don't get the scope of what's about to happen.
No.
There's not these Braveheart Dances with Wolves type cues of a big battle. It's there's some guys getting together talking about what they're going to do, and then shit just goes pie-eyed.
Yeah. And again, I have to think that this scene was a major influence on the scene in Come and See. I mean, there's a lot of the scenes in Come and See. Almost every scene in Come and See is the scene. Like, you don't want to talk about it because it's just too horrible. But you know what I mean when I say the scene.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful. It's so unrelenting. It's so horrifying. And yet it's all right there. It's unbelievable how, because like oftentimes you do something like so perfectly well, like the Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor, right? Like the perfect POV shot of like the torpedo coming down and hitting the Arizona or whatever. It's so exploitative.
Yeah.
Like when he does it, and yet somehow here it is perfect art. It is perfect. Everything is so immaculately framed, immaculately edited, camera movements, people movements, animal movements, other thing movements.
Shit is like a flame. Like there is fire control. These are wood and timber structures.
It's
going
out of control
up fast.
The men
and you got
are
extras
it.
Riding horses really close to it.
The women are getting it. The animals are getting it. There's a very disturbing shot of a horse. Horse kind of is a thing that goes throughout this movie. Apparently, it was a big thing with Tarkovsky. Horses was to him a symbol of life, and so one of
you
the
talked
first
about films that it
shots.
Made you think of. I thought of Come and See, of course, but Los Olvidados, because of the casualness of death and the cheapness of life, the ease with which like they'll blind somebody just to be like, you know, not even I won't even kill you, I'll just blind you.
Yeah.
Like as because you offended me.
Yeah.
And
that's a great point. Yeah.
Battleship Potemkin. Potemkin.
Yeah.
The something about maybe Russian directors and just the grand scope of the Russian steppes. Maybe that's part of, you know, a lot of that communist Russian architecture is huge, grand design. Like it's in the filmmaking too, because they just capture these huge, sweeping scenes. And as far as you could imagine, there's a line of people way back in the distance. Like, how did they coordinate this before,
how's that
modern
even possible?
walkie-talkie devices coordinating that shot.
And there's no digital cleanup. You know, one guy didn't hit his mark, so we're going to do this, and we're going to flip his blue eyes to brown or anything. Yeah.
We just lost lighting over there.
No, right? A cloud went in front of the sun. No, well, take it over again. Let's go back to one. Yeah.
Fucking amazing.
It's pretty amazing. And again, like I said, what I think beyond just like the technical achievement of it is, like I said, like the technical achievement plus you feel it. Like you feel the gravity, you feel the ugliness, you feel the horror, you feel like you have empathy for it, and it's not exploitative somehow. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't feel like we're just using this as a cheap way to, like, you know, get an emotional like rise out of you, you know, like there's real purpose to it. And again, that was the same as Come and See. It didn't feel exploitative. It just felt horrible.
No,
just like action, like the actual thing, like actual war.
It gave me that same feeling as Aguirre, as this was many lives lived over many decades, went through shit like this. Like people, you know, so many countless people went through shit like this. And you'll never know their names, and they were never recorded to history, but two brothers who didn't like each other just tortured generations.
Oh, right? I mean, yeah. I'm sure it felt very relevant in Russia in 1966. It feels very relevant right now in 2026. I could not help but feel like, man, yeah. People who just don't give a fuck about anyone but themselves. Rich people who want to get a little bit richer and would have anyone killed to do it. People who have all the power and want just a little more power, and they would just trample us all to do it. You know, it's just hard not to feel a twinge of recognition of what's going on right now in the world. So yeah, real heavy, heavy shit, but also, goddamn, what an amazing sequence. And again, Andre is not even really part of it until the very end, after all, he does kill like one of the invaders to save this girl, Doroshka, who he's kind of partnered up with. A holy fool, I think is the term they use.
She's an innocent mute.
Yeah.
Like a child.
Yeah, absolutely. And so he essentially decides, I'm not going to paint. I'm going to take a vow of silence. And that's just it. And meanwhile, Doroshka, it's like, it's just as horrifying in these like quiet scenes with the scene where she's braiding the dead woman's hair.
Yeah. You know?
And she's just not even thinking. She's just like, fun. I get to play with her hair like a doll.
Yeah.
And it's just like, wow. Oh, man. Brutal, brutal stuff. And then that's also kind of the next chapter as well, which is he's silent, he's toiling. Then the Tatars come and they take Doroshka, and she actually goes with them.
And it probably has a much better life.
Yeah, not a ton of fun hanging out with this dude who is just carrying. It's like, I'm just going to carry hot rocks. It's like, that's what I'm gonna do, and no rest for Andre at all. And he carries this on even into our final chapter here, besides the epilogue, which again I think we both agree this is the best sequence in the film. And it's like, already at this point you're like, damn, this movie's amazing. Like even you, who were like, the first half I was not won over. You've been won over, right? You're won over. And then whammo, you want to seal the deal? The bell. Tolls for thee, bitch. Tolls for thee. God damn it. Oh yeah. For whom? You. Woo! The bell. An actual quirky miracle. An actual artistic miracle. And this is like why I think it's such a great sequence and why it's so important to Andre, even though once again, he's not a part of it.
He's not around.
At all.
No.
Like, really, until the very, very end.
Yeah, I want to add something that's not related directly to this, but the actor and whoever did the makeup, they aged this guy really well.
Yeah.
It does not look cheesy at all. Mm-hmm. It looks pretty fucking well done.
No, it's really seamless. Yeah. I mean, the movie goes over a course of like 20 or 25 years or something like that. And at the beginning, he's very young. He actually kind of looks like Jesus at the beginning, right? He's got this short beard. He looks like the icons of Jesus that he's painting. and has a very Jesus-like demeanor as well, right? He's wandering amongst the people. He's looking for the good in people, you know, and he's doing all this penance and things like that. And yeah, but by the end, he's a haggard old man.
Haggard, right? Old man. At this point, balding.
By the 1420s, I mean, weren't we all?
Face sunk, yeah.
But yeah, so this sequence, again, it's about a bell. It's not about Andre. It's about a different type of craftsman, a different
and
type
art and expression.
Of artists. Yeah.
They commission this bell for a church. Mm-hmm. Of course, everything is patronage through the church, of course.
And the Grand Duke.
And the
Grand
Duke.
We're back to the Grand Duke, who again is like sneakily the main character in the film while having like two close-ups of his face, like literally the entire film. Because like, if you're a serf, when do you see the Grand Duke? When you're on your knees, yeah, as he's passing by, right? And that's like, that's it. But yeah, he's sneakily sort of like the guy who is pulling all the strings and who everyone is sort of working for.
And this is part of the whole casualty of death and just the harshness of the life. They come to get this bellmaker, and lo and behold, him and 3/4 of his family have died from flu. The only one surviving is the son. And he's like, I know the tricks. I know how to make a bell. And they're like, no, you can't come with us and make a bell. Sorry, your dad's dead. They don't even say sorry. It's just like, his dad's dead. He's not worth us to us at all. But he talks his way into it.
Insists, like, I'm the only one who can do it.
Yeah.
My dad gave me all the secrets. I'm the only person who can forge this bell.
This right? kid gave me Michael Keaton and Night Shift vibes.
Oh, right. I know. Yeah, it's funny because I was actually thinking, you mentioned, I can't remember if it was on air or off air, Marty Supreme, but I was thinking, like, the sort of response to Marty Supreme is that, like, oh, yeah, he's this kid, he's on his hustle. Right? Like, he's a real hustler. He's chasing his dreams. And he's doing it on his own term. He's a real hustler. I mean, no. This kid's a hustler. This little kid's a hustler. Yeah. Hey, Marty Supreme, try forging a fucking bell.
Yeah.
Okay? Right? Fucking ping pong battle and forge a bell. In the 14th century.
Right.
Okay? You don't have shoes. Right? Yeah. You're in the mud and the shit. And by the way, if the bell doesn't ring or has any kind of flaw in it, you're losing your head.
Your like, whole crew is going to die.
This kid is on his grind. Yes. All right? Like, this kid is doing it. And it is like, it's an amazing sequence because you're just like, as a viewer, you're like, seems like this kid's has no fucking clue what he's doing. But he's insisting. He is fighting for his vision. Every single thing, he's like, I know, you don't know. Yeah. I know, you don't know. Oh, well, that's not the way your dad did it. Well, then my dad doesn't know. But also, he told me, and I'm the only one who knows. You know, yeah. Like, he is just all he's doing. And as he gets deeper and deeper and deeper into it, and the more he fights, the more, like, defeated he seems, the more kind of detached he seems. He's just, like, and again, like, hovering over it all is this, like, wanton cruelty we've seen, like, throughout the film. The closer he gets to the actual forging of the bell, forget just, like, digging the hole, finding the clay, you know, all that kind of, like, setup stuff. Once you get to the actual forging of the bell, the reality of the fact that, like, you're gonna die, like,
yeah,
now, like, if you don't do this exactly fucking right, like the suspense building up in the scene where they take out the bell finally and the tolling of the bell, I mean, it's pretty powerful stuff, you know what I mean? Like, the tension and the release that he feels at the end of it, and how it's just like, so it takes so much out of him. It inspires Andre so much. And then, of course, what do we find out? He had no fucking clue what he was doing. No clue. The mud. Yeah, this has to be us. This is the perfect mud. Nope. Lying. I can do this like without putting the buttress inside the bell and the scout. Nope. Made it all up. All made up, and it worked perfectly. Like I say, a miracle. Like, an actual miracle out of art. And what does it cause in the world but like actual joy? Like, yes. And some sort of like connection to the transcendent, connection to God.
You could be like the guy at the beginning who actually knew what he was doing and knew how to build a balloon to something nobody had ever done before and fly it for a little bit and die doing it. Or you could be a kid who acts like he knows what he's doing, can organize, and works his ass off. And then, by the grace of God, you're just saved that it works. And yet, what does that mean? Like, are you the artist? Or did you just get lucky? The crowd loved that. The crowd hated the first guy. And he right. was actually the incompetent one. And all of it doesn't matter because the Grand Duke is going to put his name on this fucking thing.
No,
and in
exactly.
300 years, it's going to be known as Isbell.
Exactly. The most cruel person in the world is the person who's going to... His name will survive.
Yeah.
And this kid will be absolutely forgotten in history. Yeah. And then, like you say, in the middle of these two extremes, at the beginning and the bell and the prologue of the sort of parachute hang glider, you have Andre, right? Like a legendary, like all-time great Russian artist, one of the most important artists in history, certainly, of that era, who was constantly besieged by... We see him besieged by doubt. We see him besieged by...
temptation.
Artist block.
Yeah.
Right? By temptation. By jealousy. With the pagans. He denies his own talent. He goes silent and stops creating because he sees so much horribleness in the world and sees it in himself as well. And then at the end is finally inspired, like, I'm going to come back and reconnect with the world, reconnect with God, reconnect with art, reconnect with all of it, because he sees this is what it can do. This is what it can do. And then the final sequence is actual art, which is a sort of like meditative way to kind of come out of the film, because it starts with just like these extreme close-ups where you can actually see like the defects in the wood and things like that coming out, almost abstract the way it is. And then as it goes on, we see more, and it culminates in his most famous work, which is the Holy Trinity. So it's just really kind of like, it's a way to sort of like, I think, bring you out of the film without you just sitting there like catching your breath, you know, and just sweating bullets. But that's the movie. It's Andrei Rublev. Quirky, we talked a lot about it, but was there anything we didn't talk about that you wanted to bring up?
No, I think we nailed it. Just the pure spectacle of it.
Truly.
And,
truly.
It has to be seen to be believed, really. It really, really does. That's not hyperbole.
No.
And it's influenced things from, like you said, Come and See, down to like Game of Thrones, like the way it does things, you see it ripple into all kinds of like medieval art.
Yeah, I mean, I think even lots of films influenced by it. I was thinking about Son of Saul, which is a movie that won the Best Foreign Film Oscar maybe 10 years ago, and set in a concentration camp. And it's a film that is so like technically perfect and yet horrifying at the same time, and on this amazing scale that is both like right in your face personal, and yet is again the spectacle, the scale of it, the epic scope of it is like kind of horrifying, terrifying, amazing, unbelievable. So I think Tarkovsky, Andrei Rublev, still inspiring filmmakers today, as it should, because it really is an amazing film. I'm so glad I finally saw it again. It's just one of those like top of the list films of like, it's on every freaking list and I've never seen it. And I'm so glad that I finally did. And the main reason I didn't is because it's 3+ hours long. This is why I'm so glad that we have this podcast. It's so much easier to do it when you're forced to do it.
Yes.
Which is, I think, fits the era as well. I think the communists in 1966 would agree, so much easier when you force them. But yeah, that's Andrei Rublev. So let's remind everybody about our rating system. We rate, of course, on the slight or sound scale. If we both think it was a sound selection by the critics, canon worthy, then kaboom, light them up, into the cannon fodder canon it goes. If one or both of us thought it was a wee bit slight, no canon, but we will put up for a vote a slighted film not in the Sight and Sound top 250 to put in its place. Quirky, Andrei Rublev, slight or sound?
Oh, big time sound. Yeah, this is a very sound film. Spectacle, beauty, technologically, just technically, just amazing. Watching a master use his craft to tell you a story. Just it, with every image being, you know, something you're like, God damn, how did he do this? I can't recommend it high enough because of that whole second half. The mm-hmm. first half builds to it, but the second half yeah. is what cements it.
Yeah, just be patient, meditate on it, think about it, hold with it, and it'll all pay off in that second half. Absolutely. Yeah. Sound selection for me too. No doubter, first ballot selection. Well, we don't have multiple ballots, so only ballot selection. Quirky, let me ask you this, though, just so we get a full Sophie's Choice kind of view of your picks. Andrei Rublev or Come and See?
Come and See.
Andrei Rublev or Mirror?
Andrei Rublev.
Okay, well, I know where you're at, and I feel the exact same way as you. Good to know.
That's what we thought about Andrei Rublev and Come and See and Mirror. Did you watch it with us? Had you seen any of those? Have you seen it before? We'd love to hear your take on the film. Leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app or contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dare Daniel Pod. Tell us your thoughts.
Summoning the random number generator gods. Yeah, it's the time of the show where we select the film we'll be reviewing on the next episode in 2 weeks. I've got a random number generator here. I've got a list that is numbered. Do you see the connection between the two? Okay, you ready for me to push the button, Quirky?
Go for it.
The die is cast. And what did you get for us, you old son of a bitch and die? What has it got for us? It's got a green ray. Oh my God, it's got a lay ray onvert. Hey, we got a lay rayon vert situation, Quirky. I don't want to warn you, but we've got a green ray. We've got a green ray. Yeah,
I don't know if this is a film reference or a dice reference, or I'm very confused.
It's all over the place. It's the green ray. It's the 1986 film directed by Eric Romare. Do you know Eric Romare? Are you familiar with Eric Romare?
No. I don't know.
Eric Romare was in a... well, you watch Nouvelle Vague, right?
Yeah.
Well, he was in there for like 5 seconds. There was an on-screen thing that said Eric Romare, and he was like, I am Eric Romare, whatever. Like, yeah, so Eric Romare. He was part of the that whole Cahiers du Cinéma group. Started okay. as critic, became a filmmaker. He made the Four Seasons films. He made the Six Moral Tales, and he made... The Green Ray, in a very long and prolific career. I'll read you the letterbox synopsis of The Green Ray. A lonely Parisian woman comes to terms with her isolation and anxieties during a long summer vacation.
Okay.
The Green Ray, it's available to watch on the Criterion Channel. You know we love the Criterion Channel. We get no money, they get our money, so you know it's good. It's also available to rent on all your usual podcast apps. It is 99 minutes long. If you know Romare, he's not an action guy. He's a talk guy. You know, makes very talky films. But this whole idea of a lonely woman comes to terms with her isolation and anxieties during a long vacation feels so Romare. That is so fucking Romare, and I love it. I've never seen The Green Ray. I've seen all 6 Moral Tales, and I've seen, I think, 3 of the 4 seasons. And I've seen 1 or 2 other ones, but I have not seen The Green Ray, so I'm very excited to see this film. Quirky, you don't have any familiarity with Romare at all? This
is none. First time. No.
That's awesome. That's great. There's no real recognizable actors that I'm seeing here in the cast. Marie Riviere, Amira...
A guy Shrek-y, that looks like Jack Nicholson is on the
Sylvie Richez, a guy with a red thing on his head. Mm. Yeah, Jack Nicholson, Bill Hader looking kind of guy. A little bit of a Mary Steenburgen and Cher woman mm-hmm. over here. Yeah, maybe Bonnie Bedelia. Yeah. Never seen it. Looking forward to it. 99 minutes. It's like half as long as Andrei Rublev. Yeah. So
could watch it twice.
Change of pace. Yeah, why not? Watch it twice or 4 times on the 2/3, you know, where you speed it up 1.2. Anyway, Green Ray, 2 weeks. Check it out.
Until then, follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com, find Support the Show in the menu, or look for the Donate button. If you're a fan of new movies, listen to Daniel review the top films of the day on Single Take with Daniel Barnes. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I'm Daniel Barnes. And until next time, woe unto hypocrites, and save us a seat in the back row. My two taglines.